Good morning. We've got Omo with us, and Omo phoned into the Liberty NZ podcast about a week or so ago, and we were talking about weather modification and weather warfare and that type of thing, geoengineering. And you've got a different idea, haven't you, Omo? I wonder if you'd share that with us.
So it was only by good fortune that I came across your podcast, and I was just listening in on the Podbean app, and people were talking about chemtrails, and I've got a bit of an interest in flying and other things, and I've sort of had a good think about it, and I think I typed in the text about credibility, because a lot of people say a lot of things, there's a lot of emotion involved in a lot of issues, and so what I put to you in the text was that credibility is a very precious resource. It's hard won, easily lost, and almost impossible to get back.
Yes.
And I try and bring that sort of approach to nearly everything that I think about, and chemtrails is one of them. And I do have a background as a commercial airline pilot and as an engineer, aircraft engineer. And I, from my position, as I stated the other night when I spoke with you, that, you know, I've crawled all through aeroplanes and I've been flying them for decades, and there is no equipment on any of the commercial jets that I've ever flown that would be in any way remotely connected with something like what people allege chemtrail distribution systems.
Yes. Well, on that same podcast, the live cast, there was a lady called Ella, and she said that her husband loaded them onto the aircraft, and he was told not to worry about it when he was asking what was it. What do you think about when people say things like that?
Well, again, you know, I'm open to listening to anybody, but we've got to have, you know, good checkable evidence. I have the evidence of my own eyes, you know, and as I say, and understanding the science of what creates contrails. I mean, if people want to know about that, we could talk about that a little, perhaps.
Well, why are there so many? Yeah, that's a good thing. Well, why are there so many in the sky now? They're everywhere, aren't they? You see them, and they seem to lurk, hang around for a long while. And here in New Zealand, they all seem to go from north to south when I look out. I haven't seen that many of them, but I remember being in London in 1996, and there was a few, but they were crossing all over the place then. But I suppose, what causes them? What's the technical reason for it?
Well, a great place to start. So just cover the basics of what they are. So they're a cloud type. They're obviously white. They're way up in the sky, very high. You'll very rarely see one this part of the world below about 30,000 feet. And now I'm talking from direct personal experience. They are caused by the condensation of water vapor molecules clumping together, as any cloud does, until they form droplets that are big enough to reflect light, and we see them as a cloud. And we can see this happening in the clouds, the cumulus clouds, the nice puffy white ones you see outside, or in the cirrus clouds or the alta cirrus, or many different cloud types that we see at high altitudes. The difference between the clouds that the rain falls out of at low levels, the cumulus clouds and so on, and the high altitude ones is the high altitude ones are all ice. And the mechanism that they're formed by, and the reason we see more of them these days, is that previously jet engines were effectively straight through. All of the air that went through the engine gets very hot. It was used to combust the fuel in the engine and create thrust. With the advances in technology, more efficient engines and so on, we move to what we call high bypass turbofan engines, and that's why when you look in the front of the jet engine, you can see a big round, people would call it a propeller. It's just the first stage of a multi-stage compression system, but only a small part of the air that goes through the engine actually goes through the hot section. So much of the air goes around the outside of the hot part of the engine, so it's not heated up anywhere near as much, but it is highly compressed. And when you compress air, the water molecules together, you'll get a vapor trail. And that's why we see today, we see them much more and much more regularly, shall I say, than we used to in the old days of the early jet engines. Also, with more efficient engines, it's one of the things that causes these condensations is the provision of a nucleus, a small bit of dust, or in the case of an engine, jet engine would be a soot particle, which will also form as a place for water droplets to coalesce and form a water droplet. But as soon as it hits the outside air, it turns to ice. And that's why these high altitude clouds, these contrails, look like any other cirrus cloud. And you talked about them going up and down New Zealand. That's because the jets only fly up and down New Zealand. When they're going across New Zealand, they're departing or arriving, they're at altitudes generally below about 20,000 feet, which you won't see contrails. So the aircraft that depart every day to go to Australia and, you know, Asia and everywhere else, are climbing away from the coast, you won't see them. But we regularly see contrails out over the ocean when you're out there flying.
Ah, so where I am, they've normally, if they take off from Auckland, they're probably at around, probably only, would they be about 30,000 feet by the time you get to the far north, so, you know, the Bay of Islands? What would they be at, taking off about 450 knots or something, wouldn't they?
It's about 200 miles, roughly. That's only a ballpark. But right. It's a couple hundred miles to get to top of the line, yes.
What do you say about people that have said they've seen spraying at low level? Not agricultural spraying, but military aircraft spraying. Would that be cloud seeding? That's different again, isn't it?
Cloud seeding is, once again, the provision of a nucleus. From what I understand, I'm not, I claim no expertise in this, but my understanding is it's a silver iodide, silver iodide is the chemical that is produced by these flares that they put on the back of the wings of small turboprop aeroplanes or fairly big piston engine aeroplanes, because the cloud seeding that you're talking about is trying to force rain out of cumulus clouds. And once again, as I say, that's below about 20,000 feet. So you won't see jets doing that.
Right.
As to people totally saying different. That they saw something.
Mm.
Yeah. If people have got a camera and they can video it, it'd be great. Let's see it. You know, but again, we've got to have testable evidence. The allegations and eyewitness statements, you know, really need, credibility is hard to get.
I've interviewed Claire Swinney on the Northland Weather Watch, I think she is. She's been doing it for quite a long time. And she's on my podcast if you ever get to have a look at that. And also Samantha Edwards, she interviewed, that was about smart cities, and basically about 5G. We were chatting about 5G too before. So have I put that to bed about the chemtrails, contrails? I think that's very convincing. I think you're right. The engines have changed, and so you don't have as much air going right through the hot part. Yeah, a lot more engine. That's why we're seeing them. But, we love to jump on a conspiracy theory, don't we?
it's human nature. Exciting.
Yeah.
People have not had much to do for a couple of years, in a very uncertain time. it's clear to everyone, I think, that things aren't right with the world. You know, and when we compare, obviously I'm getting on, when we compare the times that we recall of our youth, and this may be age-induced, but things do seem to be going a bit awry, particularly in the Western world these days, you know, with marketing and technology and big data and big tech and so on. So a lot of people have, you know, suspicions. They don't feel good about things, and it's easy to jump on something. And again, the focus has always got to be making good decisions is based on good data.
Yeah, I sort of felt something was up. First of all, I thought, maybe it is a real virus. I don't know, you know, forgetting all my homeopathic training, that the viruses don't even exist. We studied Beecham's theory, and we basically, Louis Pasteur, we were taught that he plagiarized Beecham's work and brought in the germ theory, which the pharmaceutical companies just absolutely love. But I didn't want to get onto that yet, but we should talk about that, because I'm sure you'll have an opinion on that. What about the 5G? 5G, is that a dangerous thing? Is that a weapon? Was that initially designed by the military as a weapon, or is that another misnomer?
Once again, I can only draw on my personal experience. As I alluded to, I have an engineering background long time ago in avionics, radio, radar, and instrumentation and so on.
Yeah.
And the 5G is just the fifth generation of a number of iterations of cellular data transmission technology. So the 5G works in a particular frequency band, which is much higher than the old 4G. It's why the same as your microwave. It's effectively radar. Your microwave works around about 2 gigahertz. That's 2,000 million waves per second. 5G is significantly higher. But the idea that 5G radiation is in somehow able to interfere with your cellular function, which is something I heard allegations of it years ago, and I had a look at it, and I can see no evidence for it. The wavelength of 5G transmissions, or 5G radiation that they use, is way too big to have any direct effect on cellular function. It may be able to agitate, you know, like your microwave does, the water molecules in food and so on. So when you put your, you know, if you use your mobile phone beside your head, it's a radio transmitter and receiver, and it can cause local heating, but actually interfering with the cellular function, I don't believe that's the case. The wavelength is too long.
Mm.
And this is what's really important, something I failed to say, that these sorts of frequencies we're talking about with 4G or 5G or your microwave or your Wi-Fi at home, they are non-ionizing. They're non-ionizing radiation. They are not of sufficiently short wavelength or energy intensity to disrupt cellular function, unlike gamma rays and X-rays and so on from, you know, cosmic radiation, which is, it's incredibly high energy and incredibly short wavelength. It can, and that's why we end up with, you know, sort of things like cellular malfunctions when they're exposed to these sorts of radiations. It's why we go to so much trouble to protect astronauts in outer space, because they're outside the ionosphere, which is the layer of the atmosphere, or the very high upper atmosphere, that protects us from high energy, you know, sort of particles from outer space, cosmic radiation.
We are talking with Omo, and he is an airline pilot, so he does know a thing or two. Omo, what about the vaccines? Did they force you to take one to keep your job, or what was your decision on that?
So, I lost my job because I politely declined an invitation to be vaccinated with the Pfizer technology, the Pfizer mRNA vaccination. I actually volunteered to have if it would keep my job, a non-mRNA style, which is an adenovirus-vected, I forgot the name, Novavax, right, which was supposed to be available in New Zealand, and because I refused the Pfizer, I was told that I was non-compliant, and so I lost my job.
Well, it's good to not be compliant.
that's all it was about,
yeah.
Compliance. And I think everybody, you know, I talk about that sense of unease or disquiet that a lot of people have, you know, just your basic survival instincts tell you if someone's screaming at you to do something, then it's possibly the outcome isn't possibly going to be very good for you. And that was the basis of a lot of people. And I think a lot more people did refuse to get jabbed even in the first couple of rounds than actually the authorities admit, because it's a bad look for them.
Sure.
But a lot of people thought, no, this doesn't sound right. It smells. It doesn't pass the sniff test.
Yes.
You know, when you know, there was this suppression of early treatment. Doctors are told, you know, they were sending patients away. They say, go away, come back when you're cyanotic, when, you know, when your lips turn blue type thing. Mm-mm. That they weren't allowed to use off-label drugs. They weren't allowed to, you know, effectively treat people. And when they did, that was to go on ventilators. There's a whole heap of stuff about that. But a lot of people, just quite sensibly, were apprehensive that the pressure being applied, if it was any good, they wouldn't have to force you, you know. And so, and that was one of the things that sort of next standing up. And I have an interest in a few things, and I knew a little bit about virology and immunology from ostensibly the bird flu, and prior in my career, SARS in 2001, I think it was. Mm. And then bird flu was 2006 or something. And so I took a bit of an interest, because airline operations are the primary vector for this pandemic. And there will be pandemics. There have been throughout history. Mm. It's just that they can spread a lot faster, like literally circle the globe in 24 hours these days.
Because of the Because of the planes. Are you familiar with Nicole Sirotic? She launched the frontline nurses, not frontline doctors, but frontline nurses in the United States. I'll give you a quote from her. She said, "I didn't see a single patient die of COVID." And I've got a friend who was an ICU nurse for the last 9 years up until they sacked him. And he said that, "I saw people that were vaccine injured. They didn't have COVID."
Again, this is an unqualified opinion. Mm. But people don't die of viral infections. They die of secondary complications, you know.
Yeah.
And flu does kill people, you know. There's no question. And it was clear. I was overseas when COVID first surfaced. And because I'd taken interest in this sort of area of medical science during the bird flu pandemic, or potential bird flu pandemic, what didn't turn into a pandemic, we dodged a bullet there. But because I knew what I knew, I was of the opinion that, you know, I couldn't get back to New Zealand fast enough and say lock the country down, absolutely lock it down rock solid, because we don't know what the infection fatality rate of this novel virus was, supposedly a novel zoonotic, something that had been in a resident species other than humans, such as birds or pigs, or they tried to say bats, and had jumped into humans through chance. And it didn't matter what the mechanism was. The fact was that there was word out of a potential very bad virus had been released, a respiratory virus of some kind, and that until we knew what we call the infection fatality rate, it's not a case fatality rate, it's the infection fatality rate, the number of people that are exposed to the virus
and die
from it,
yeah,
that you've got to err on the side of caution, lock the world down, you know. But there was no question by March, April at the latest of 2020, we knew that it was going to be just a really, really, and it was a very, very serious disease, particularly for the people immune compromised, diabetes, mellitus, the obese, and the elderly, as and flu, influenza A does every year. It kills lots and lots and lots of people.
It does. In fact, in 1985, I think it was, 1,700 people died from complications of having the flu. That was our record. Normally it's about 600 to 800, isn't it? But it was 1,700 that year, 1985. That was a bad year.
Was it?
Yeah. According to the internet.
And so again, you know, the narrative didn't fit. You know, that there's all this screaming and not gnashing of teeth, but, you know, there are all these panic merchants all over the media everywhere.
Yeah.
So we saw... you know, suppression of people who were saying that there are alternative treatments available using, you know, antivirals, off-label antivirals and things.
Is that like hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin?
Ivermectin. I do know that it won the Nobel Prize for the discoverers of it, and I think that was in 2006 or something.
Yeah.
And it is rated as number two only to penicillin as being to benefit of mankind, and there have been billions and billions of doses administered without... virtually with no side effects at all. It is an amazing drug. And again, I knew that because I'd lived in malarial places and we'd taken lots of chloroquine derivatives, you know. And they are fairly safe.
For malaria.
Teasering and things like that. But ivermectin ivermectin's in a class of its own, you know. It's unbelievably safe, and yet we've got all these people screaming that, you know, in public, that no, you can't use it, it's horse paste.
Nonsense. I mean hydroxychloroquine, they take these little tablets in Africa, they call them Sunday tablets. Every Sunday they take them so that I get a bellyache in some, you know, African countries.
Oh, okay,
and they're just available over. I think you buy them at the local shop up the road. And ivermectin too. I mean, they're all sort of without prescription, really, weren't they? In a lot of countries.
Absolutely. Mm. Ivermectin was developed as an antiparasitic for. I can't say the name. Ochinerosis or something. A parasite that gets in through river water. It's called river blindness, and it ends up, the parasite somehow migrates to, I believe it's in your eyes. It's a really ugly thing, and it'll send you blind, and I believe it'll be fatal.
Blimey.
And ivermectin was developed as an antiparasitic for that, and it just so happens that it has antiviral properties as well. You know, lots and lots of drugs are used, what they call off-label, I couldn't understand the suppression. Or, you know, this narrative that ivermectin was somehow unsafe or dangerous or a veterinary medicine. And again, that just added to the disquiet about the whole thing. And it all led towards my decline in the mRNA technology.
Well,
it just didn't smell right.
Yeah. Apparently, doctors here, they were sent information that there were tests done using hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin, but I think it was hydroxychloroquine. And but they gave them massive doses and people died. And so, of course they gave them huge doses. They gave them the wrong dose and they killed them. That's terrible. That's shocking that people would do that just to prove a point. And that was the information that was sent out through probably the WHO and came to New Zealand, and that's why they banned using it. And I've got a friend who owns 6 pharmacy stores. I won't say where, what city, but he owns 6 at least. And he said that the government told he's got stockpiles of hydroxychloroquine and he wasn't allowed to sell it. They banned him selling it. Now that's the bit sniffy, isn't it?
Yeah. Again, I don't know about what dosage regimes and stuff were tried. It was just superficially, you know, from looking at what are the lawyery types of prima facie, looking at it from the outside on first glance, it all smelt wrong. You know, we've got this. We knew that it wasn't going to be a disease. I'm you know, getting on pushing 60, and the stats by the middle of 2020. As I say, May 2020, was that my survival rate as a reasonably healthy sub-60-year-old male, my survival rate was something like 99.98%. The infection fatality rate was 0.02% for someone in my case.
And yet we had this
panic, these panic merchants on the television telling us, oh, it's deadly and blah, blah,
every
blah.
Every day.
Targeted protection for the people most at risk.
We've still got Michael Baker.
But yeah, it was insane. It was insane. Oh, so the whole narrative stuff.
Look, I've got something here. Michael Baker, I've got something from him. He's still saying, he's still going on that it's the biggest killer in the country at the moment, COVID-19. Now, where did he say that? I can't find it. It was there, but it came out not that long ago, just in the last few days, because, that's right, the pandemic is over, according to WHO. World Health Organization, WHO, has declared that the COVID-19 is no longer represents a global health emergency after more than 3 years, nearly seven. No, that's not the one. There must have been another one where Michael Baker came out and said, we've still got to, we still have to make sure we're vaccinated. Far out. I can't believe they're still pushing vaccines on people after all that we know out there. We just know too much now to be fooled by an idiot like him. I wonder what they're paying him.
Precisely. Well, look, lots of people made similar decisions, you know. As I say, the vast majority of people, when you talk to them in the street, you know, all tends to disquiet. But they did, you know, there was the best marketing campaign ever, you know, two shots for summer, save grandma, protect the health system, your kids can give it to other people, all the sorts of nonsense. It was from every angle, and there should be no shame for anyone to feel that they did the wrong thing by being sucked in, because we all know now it's really obvious, you know, that it's neither safe nor effective. So effective was the big one, you know, that we're told it was, you know, and if it was going to be a really bad pandemic and it was going to kill billions of people, then make it mandatory.
We'd be lining up, lining up anyway. You wouldn't need to make it mandatory. We'd be down there rolling our sleeves up.
Absolutely. So that, you know, the panic merchants and so on, you know, I think the very good Dr. Baker is probably seeking a bit of relevance, maybe. I don't know.
Well, he's hanging on to it. He's beating it like really a dead horse.
Good luck to him. But, he's got to fill his coffers somehow.
Yeah.
But someone should ask him, how does he explain the excess mortality statistics that are coming out daily now? You know, sort of every week we see increased mortality, excess mortality in all of the Western countries, all the jabbed countries. Excess mortality is through the roof. Pfizer documents just released, and I do say, you know, and I get called a conspiracy theorist because I go and read, as I said, about credibility, I go and read the source data. So I've been reading the bits that I can comprehend. I'm not completely stupid. I've been reading the Pfizer drops when they come out and when I have time. Mm. And the one recently, just the last couple of days, was about the adverse effects or the effects. This is Pfizer's own documents that are available on the PHMPT website. The effects of the on pregnant and lactating mums, and I think it was something like nearly 50% spontaneous abortion post vaccination in the first for those in the first trimester. So it was horrendous, and there was clear that this is Pfizer's data where they openly admit that it was being transferred by breast milk to babies, that it was infecting the fetus. It was interfering with the sex organ development in males, in baby males. You know, this is Pfizer's own data. It's out there, but the vast majority of people don't have time to go and read it. You know, but we should be asking, you know, people like Baker and who was that purple headed Sheila? You know,
the beach
how do
whale.
They explain the excess mortality data? How do they explain these? You know, this is Pfizer's data, and this is what we need. And that was one of the I sound a bit bloody agitated now, but this was the big
makes
thing
you angry. Good on you. That's what's wrong with New Zealanders. We're not passionate
there was
enough.
No informed. Exactly. There was no informed debate. There was no public discourse where you had the proponents and the antis able to get up and debate like they're supposed to do in Parliament if they don't pass things under urgency in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
Sorry, it's a quick dig at on politics.
Good.
But you know, there was no open debate. There was no public discourse between learned individuals. You know, you've got some of the world's foremost experts in medicine have been completely cancelled and silenced by big tech on this. You know, the likes of Peter McCullough, the world's most cited cardiologist.
Mm.
You know, and he was jumping up and down about it. You know, all sorts of people. And
Robert Malone.
Heard nothing about. Pardon me.
Peter McCullough. Robert Malone.
He was a postgrad guy, I think. He was working on the mRNA technology as a postgrad, wasn't he?
Yeah.
In the 90s,
so. He's right into it.
Genetic GMO vaccines have been talked about for a long time. Oh, now there's a subject that came to mind recently. It was the vaccination through the chemtrail people. They talk about vaccination, aerosol vaccination. And I do know about something about this aerosol vaccination program. There was a PubMed document, and people could find it if they wanted. I actually read it a long time ago because of this chemtrail thing that people were talking about. And there was a peer-reviewed study done on aerosolized vaccination. And what that meant was not distributing vaccines from airplanes. It meant via the same infection route that you get it. So they would spray something into your nose, a nasal spray. That's what it was. It wasn't going around with a bloody spray gun, you know, spraying the suburbs or dropping it from aeroplanes.
Mm.
But the chemtrailers and the anti-vaccination people jumped on this and said, "Oh, this is what they're doing with the chemtrails. They're trying to mass vaccinate people from the air." That's not the case at all. Aerosolized vaccination was the use of effectively a nasal spray
to deliver
the
makes more sense.
Deactivated pathogen, the virus or the germ or whatever, directly to the infectious.
How would you work out the dosage from dropping it from an aircraft?
it's just nuts. Preposterous.
Yeah.
People could even, I would hope most people are intelligent enough to go, well, how would they get the dosage right and how would they stop it spreading out, et cetera, et cetera.
And it just gives.
But anyway, so there are so many questions.
It gives information. It gives ammunition for people, the likes of Jacinda Ardern and the guy Gavin Newsom, where they're trying to stop people speaking freely on the internet, doesn't it? And then they spin that and come out and say, oh, well, this is why we've got to shut them down, because people are saying stupid things like that. We're not against free speech. We just want people to make sure they get their facts right first. But I think it's good in a way that we've got people out there saying things. Misinformation, I mean, is accidental, and I think disinformation is on purpose. But I think if there's people out there misinformed and misinforming others, I think it's a good thing, because that means that we've got to say, am I going to believe that or not? I'm going to double check that. I think it's good that we aren't just that everything we hear, we listen to it and we go and check the source ourselves. So we listen to it and don't just take it with a grain of salt at first. I think we need misinformation in a way to keep us sharp.
Yeah, I mean, it's part of our basic survival skills to the hair on the back of your neck stands up. Caveman days, you're walking along and there's a big rock in front and all of a sudden the wind is blowing from the rock towards you and you can smell lion. What would you do?
Yeah.
Keep walking towards the rock?
Run.
I don't think so. they're basic survival skills, the ability to assess changes in our environment, what's going on around us and consider, are they a threat to us? It's just unfortunate that the threat environment, if you want to call it that, is so complex. There's so much information, so much data, and people are so busy living their lives.
Yeah, that's the thing. They've got you so busy, haven't they? Working two jobs, and you don't have time to think. And thinking's hard work, actually. It's not easy to think. Real thinking is hard work. People don't want to use... You start, asking people questions about things, They often just say, their eyes glaze over and they just go, it's just too hard. I don't want to have this conversation right now. It's just, they want to live in it and just relax. They want to go back to the old pre-2020 days. Back to the 70s.
Well, very fortunate.
Take me back to the 70s.
Having a dad that was interested in just about everything, and he taught me early on, and I've taught my children as well, that the one thing I want you to do, and it's hard when you've got teenagers, believe me, because they keep asking questions, and sometimes it's difficult. Sometimes teenagers are looking to rebel a little bit and push the boundaries, and sometimes it's a bit hard to keep an even.
I had two of them. 18 cures 17, 19 cures 18, 20 cures 19. As they get older, they get better.
I'll look forward
they
to
snap
that
out of it. When they're 29, they realize you know heaps.
I did say to one recently, I said, listen, mate, why don't you move out now while you're 15 and solve the world's problems while you still know everything? But anyway.
Tidy your room before you leave.
We live in a really, really interesting world. And it's a fascinating time to be alive. And again, with teenagers, my kids aren't jabbed either. And it was very difficult for them as teenagers. We couldn't do, no one could do sport. And then when we couldn't go back to training inside, we're into various sports. And they couldn't go to the movies with their mates because they weren't jabbed. And it was difficult. Mm. I'm unbelievably glad now, and so are they, that they didn't, because what was private knowledge a couple of years ago is now public knowledge. Everyone knows that it doesn't work. And it would, from all the data that we've got available, regardless of what Mr. Baker would like to decry and all the rest of them with vested interest in promoting the vaccine, that it does appear to be unsafe. It appears that this excess mortality, it didn't come from nowhere, and it's not from COVID. There are more people dying now after all the vaccination programs than there were before. Something is wrong. And I hear all the time, correlation doesn't equal causation. And I always agree, correlation. Just because two things occur in sequence or temporally or in time, close together, doesn't mean that one caused the other. But the more of these events, the greater the weight of evidence you have, the number of times you do something and the same thing keeps happening, the greater the correlation. It implies causation. And it gets to the point where we actually, you can say, I can draw a reasonable link between that change in the environment or that thing that I did and my hand hurting or. And so I say to people, if you put your hand in the fire, you pull it out because it hurts. And if you do it again, people would say, but there's no correlation, the burn on your hand.
Of course there is, yeah.
So how many times you before you figure it out?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Precisely. This is common sense. This is native to our big brain, It's this is these things aren't hard to understand, but people with positions, and they invest emotionally in a position, and it's very hard to change that. Then you've come up against things like cognitive dissonance. You know, if the vaccine is as dangerous as is being alleged by a lot of medical, very highly medically qualified people, very highly qualified medical people, my apologies,
yes.
Then a lot of people will be doing the ostrich thing and going, oh my God, I've had two, or I've had three, or I've had four, and they're now really worried for their own health, and that will make them angry. You know, this is called cognitive dissonance, where the things that you can see are so disconnected, they're so at odds with your mental model of the world.
Yes.
This is a phenomenon we see in aircraft accidents, that you persist with a stupid course of action instead of going, no, things are wrong here, I need to solve this cognitive dissonance. And we see that in a lot of times, you know. A lot of people just, like you said, people don't want to discuss stuff. And a lot of it is because they're afraid, because people are now scared that they've been damaged.
Do you think it's fear, or do you think it's pride?
Humans are emotional animals. I don't know. I'm not a psychologist. I just know that a lot of people react emotively when it would be far better for them to make a considered, deliberate, paced decision. And that's something that, again, I refer to flying quite a bit. It's something that we learned to do a long time ago, because in aeroplanes, or decades ago, that to take a very we build structures for our decision making. There's lots of models. You know, they're usually mnemonics of some kind. NASA uses one called CLEAR. CLEAR, the one that I was trained on years ago, it was developed, I think it was British Airways, it was called GRADE, G-R-A-D-E. And what that means is that when something happens, when you've got a decision to make, you gather first all the data, and then you review it with all the qualified people in the team, and you look at all the alternatives. And the reason you do that is so that you get as wide an experience base looking at the facts and coming up with, and it's got to be facts, it's got to be good data, coming up with the alternative solutions. And then you decide and implement one of the solutions. This is a classic thing that we do all the time in airplanes. And you put that plan into effect. Say you're flying somewhere and you get a sick passenger or a minor technical issue with the airplane. And you'll have a lot of data. You know, say if it's a sick passenger, is it a heart attack? Are they dying? Or are they just having some trouble breathing? Have you got medical people on board to offer advice, that sort of stuff? Or say it's a technical issue with the airplane. You know, a fuel pump fails. Well, all right, how many have I got? How much fuel have I got? How many airports are? How far away? What are the rules say about me continuing across, say, the Tasman to Australia, or as opposed to turning around and landing at Wellington because Auckland's, you know, got bad weather? Good decisions are based on a deliberate, considered, informed, evidence-based approach. And if more people did that, I believe, now I'm lecturing, more people did that, I think that a lot less people would have bad things happening in their world, if you know what I mean. About making good decisions, Grant.
Well, that should have been what happened with the whole COVID fiasco and whether we'd vaccinate or not.
Absolutely.
And they refused.
And with lots and lots and lots of things.
They refused to...
down? Should we print money into the...
You know, go ahead.
No, just that. You're quite right. It's just about, you know, making good decisions. That's what we're equipped for. That's why we think. That's why, Michio Kaku talks about levels of consciousness, you know, engagement with your environment. He did a podcast recently with Joe Rogan. Fascinating to watch. And when he describes the way that an animal, say, I think he described a crocodile, an alligator, how it interacts with its environment, and then how a human does, and because he was talking about AI, the future of AI, and he is firmly of the belief that AI is nowhere near close to being a threat to humans, but with the advent of quantum computing, whenever that happens, and it's probably still a long way away, that may change. But it was just interesting the way that he talked about organisms interacting, different levels of organisms and how they interact with their environment, making good decisions, as I say. And that's being human. The big thing we can do is we can look into the future. We know that decisions we make today will affect us tomorrow. Animals pretty much don't.
Now, in America, it's called CLEAR, and in the UK, you're trained under the system called GRADE. Why don't our politicians have the same type of program?
Yes, I think everyone should. I mean, this what we're talking about, decision making models here, are just a part of a field of research or endeavor in professional aviation and in many other high risk or consequential enterprises. We talk about human factors, and that's to try and eliminate the human frailties and fallibilities whilst retaining the very best of our ability to make good decisions and to come up with novel solutions or to good solutions to problems that haven't occurred before. When we do that, that's what experience is for. Mm. So, yeah, everybody should be trained in good decision making.
I know. That would be better than gender studies, do you think, at school? Gender studies. Or what else is there? Or we could do Maori language. What do you think would be more important?
Well, this is
facetious sometimes.
What should we be spending at, you know, I've talked to them about tax and about how we pay tax to provide things like social support and infrastructure for society and everything else.
Yeah.
But shouldn't the taxpayer be having a say in what in what area that money is spent? And unfortunately, we don't. I'm quite sure that if you ask the vast majority of New Zealanders, should money be spent in schools on te reo, you know, Maori education, and I mean, deeper levels, spending a lot of time on it, or should it be spent on something like improving the maths and English and the science, you know, the STEM subjects for our students? And I don't think there's many New Zealanders would argue the other way. You know, there's a dollar can only be spent once. Where do we spend it? Do we spend it on STEM or do we spend it on, you know, sort of te reo education?
Or trips, on the climate change trips to town to protest, walking up and down the street, got the little kids holding banners and stuff like that. That's what I object to that.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, you know, time for students is precious. The poor old teachers are terribly stretched. They've got huge classes and they've got all sorts of issues to deal with in classrooms. That's another thing to talk about, parenting.
Mm.
But, you know, the kids' time at school actually engaged in learning is pretty short, you know, and it can't be wasted on things that could be, or time that could be better spent in stuff that really counts. And I think that's one of the big problems for Western countries, Australia, New Zealand, the US, that there's not enough focus still on the essentials, the reading, the writing, the mathematics, the science, because science is simply a way of describing the world around us. And if we don't have those basics, then we don't really ever understand what we're doing. We're just a sheep in a flock.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we're speaking with Omo, One Man's Opinion. We're allowed to say that. We're not allowed to say your real name. Best I don't know, Omo.
I'd rather.
best I don't know. So that's really good. I really appreciate that. I've enjoyed our little chat, and I'd like to chat some more when my mind is in the right gear, so that I can ask the right questions. And is there anything that you think that we haven't covered that we should cover before we finish this today?
Oh, goodness, no. No, I'm only here at your invite. You know, we had a bit of a chat the other day, and it was interesting and stimulating, and so you asked me to do this, and I thought it's an opportunity.
Mm.
To be honest, I don't think my opinions are that much different to a lot of other people, but a lot of people have neither the platform nor the willingness to stand out from the crowd, because you tend to get beaten down a bit.
You sure do in this country. They'll nail you up, they beat you into the corner, and then nail you to the wall.
There was that protest a couple of years ago and it was amazing. You looked at the videos of the number of people that came out and supported that convoy. You know, I went out and watched the one that came through Auckland, and there were literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people with flags and so on, because all of us, the unjabby, we felt isolated, marginalized, and discriminated against, discredited, you know, as if we're doing something wrong. And to come out to when that convoy thing started, it was amazing, you know, the number of people, and you realize suddenly you weren't alone. And so I strongly question the statistics being put about that, oh yes, 95% of New Zealand is vaccinated. It may be true, it may not be, I don't know. But suddenly I realised there are a lot more people out there thought the same way I do, that are good, decent, hardworking people, caring for their families, trying to do the right thing, but a bit confused as to what's going on, because the picture at the moment is confused, it's blurred.
And Ardern and her ilk tried to make us all seem like far-right extremists. And tried to demonise us, and we were just ordinary, everyday mums and dads, brothers and sisters, just wanting to get on with our life. And she was taking that away from us.
Yep.
She was saying that they were bullying people there. Well, there was no bullying whatsoever. That no one was disrupted. Everyone, they were outside on the grounds of Parliament, which they're entitled to do. Been doing it for 100 years or more. And that's what you do in a democracy. You go to Parliament and you express your concern and you protest the government about
Absolutely.
Something. And they're supposed to come down the steps and meet the people and listen to them. But they didn't do that. And that's because they know that they don't have answers for the tyrannical way that they've treated us. It's abominable how they've treated us.
I couldn't agree with you more, Grant. And and perhaps grist for another chat another time. Because I did go along. And I cannot say how, you know, coming from I've talked about military and very professional discipline background, to mix with so many people who were there for all the right reasons, and they were just wonderful people. It was a real eye opener for me. You know, the hippies, most of them. Well, not most, a lot of them. You know, and they were just good, genuine people. They were wonderful. You know, and it was a real inspiration to be there. And as I say, it was the same. You know, when I went out to watch the convoy, to see the number of people that were out there, just genuine everyday Kiwis who just want to get on with their lives and not be interrupted by Big Brother. Or Big Sister, as she was then.
Thank you very much, Omo. Anyway, I've really enjoyed this, and I wish it could go for a bit longer, but I guess we've all got to keep moving on with our day. We've got a bit of sunshine now for a while. Is it good where you are?
It is indeed. It's nice to have a break, and I really feel for all the people that copped the rough end of the stick out of the weather a bit recently. We better not go down the climate change nonsense now, anyway.
No. All right, well, let's talk again. That's Omo, one man's opinion, and I'd love to have you on a regular basis. It'll be brilliant, Omo. Thank you very much for agreeing to chat with me.
Look forward to it. Thank you very much, Grant.
Thanks a lot. Bye now.
Bye-bye.